The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky, in France. And the tech team in London are...
Charles Arthur.
Jemima Kish.
Alex Hearn.
And Samuel Gibbs.
That's what they called a full house, Alex.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I was going to say exactly that, Jemima. We have a full house. And on the show this week...
How do people relate to each other and their spaces in a world where buildings and devices become kind of dynamic and responsive?
Architect and artist Usman Haque discusses the possibilities and the consequences of a networked world, a world in which the Internet of Everything applies to everything. Also, we discussed this week's big news stories, including Google gobbling up another high-tech startup. This time, it's the UK artificial intelligence company DeepMind. Spying, there's an app for that. Oh, hold on. Every app will do. We discuss the data leaks on our devices, and we take a slice of the Apple Mac-shaped birthday cake as the Mac turns 30. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In a Pac-Man-like frenzy, Google this week chomped down another juicy power pellet of a tech startup, the UK-based DeepMind. Ooh, fancy. Samuel, Charles, you both wrote about this one on The Guardian this week. Who wants to pitch in first? Samuel.
So yes, DeepMind, practically a company that nobody had ever heard of before, but one of the most cutting-edge artificial intelligence companies set up right here in London 2 years ago. The story behind the company is quite fascinating. It was set up by Demis Hassabis, child chess prodigy, teenage developer of Theme Park at Bullfrog, and five times Mind Sports Olympiad champion. If it makes any difference, he gave up his competitive Mind Sports because essentially it looked like nobody could beat him. So this guy was and still is an impressive mind. He switched from computer gaming, where he kind of first came up with his love of artificial intelligence, to go and do neuroscience, obtaining a PhD from UCL in cognitive neuroscience. And then after a spell in academia, left to set up DeepMind to basically really concentrate on the idea of artificial intelligence and deep learning. And that's where DeepMind came from, set up with Shane Legg and Mustafa Suleiman.
I mean, I have to say, if you were going to be sort of writing a novel and you set him up as the character, people would say, yeah, it's a bit unbelievable though, isn't it? A child chess prodigy, and then he's a brain sports thing, and then he's a neuroscientist who produces cutting-edge stuff about memory. And I mean, you're sort of over-egging a bit, but no, this guy is real.
He's the real deal.
You know what else, Charles? He's actually a really nice guy. I met him back in the day when I was covering computer games, and of course, he was Peter British... computer game developer guru Peter Molyneux's child prodigy, really brought into the fold there. So he's always been an impressive guy. I'm fascinated, of course, by the choice of name, DeepMind. That sounds like something out of science fiction.
I guess so. I mean, though, if you're sort of to call it sort of shallow brain, then I doubt anyone would Google come knocking on your door?
I don't know. That's the whole what we only use 1% of our brains or something. You could spin it. I'm sure you could spin it, Charles.
Possibly. I mean, what they came up with is very impressive, certainly from the description, which is a system which was able to look at what was presented on a video game, an Atari video game, and work out how to play it. I mean, for a lot of people, who've never seen Space Invaders, for example, if you stuck them in front of Space Invaders, they would struggle mightily to work out the exact tactics that you have to use in order to maximize your score.
And if you go back 2 years to co-founder Shane Legg's comments on an AI message board, which were unearthed after this, you find that the fact that DeepMind achieved this goal is, to him, quite important. He was asked whether he could think of any milestone which, if it was reached, he would expect human-level AI to be developed within 5 years? And his answer, back in 2011, was, when a machine can learn to play a really wide range of games from perceptual stream input and output and transfer understanding across games, I think we'll be getting close. That sounds an awful lot like the product that DeepMind went on to develop.
They're basically trying to get a computer to think like a human, and a video game is a great test, especially with the stuff that we could do now.
Charles, how does this fit in with Google's other recent acquisitions? I'm thinking about the drones. I'm thinking about, you know, some of the other stuff that they've been doing recently. It sounds to me like they actually want to expand their offering of their predictive search engines. Is that where they're going with this?
Well, there are two strands, really, in what Google has been doing in acquisitions. So, I mean, drones was much more what Amazon has been talking about. There is a strand of what Google is doing which is very much focused on robotics. And that's what Andy Rubin, who was the guy who set up Android, the company which was then bought by Google in 2005, he then led the whole Android project inside Google until sort of spring of 2013, when he went off into Google X to lead all of its robotics. And they've done a lot of buying of robotics companies. They bought about 8 in the space of a couple of months towards the end of last year, including one called Bot and Dolly, which did the 2-ton cameras which he used in the film Gravity. So basically in that film, Sandra Bullock was essentially static, wearing a sort of spaceship costume. And these cameras would wheel around and come whizzing towards her face and then suddenly stop. And she had to not flinch while she was doing this. And those are the sorts of systems that these guys, Bot and Dolly, have done, which Google has now bought. They've also bought a company called Boston Dynamics, which has contracts with the US military and can make robots that can climb up walls and jump 30 feet in the air and other faintly scary things. So that's one strand there. DeepMind doesn't seem to be going into that element of Google. They're emphasizing this is much more going to be about search. Although, you know, looking forward, you wonder, well, doesn't it all become part of the same thing? If the robotics is part of what Google's going to be doing, then doesn't it all just, you know, become part of all the same thing? And so the concerns about what Shane Legg was talking about of, you know, do we make sure that if it's intelligent, it's nice to us first, perhaps becomes more pertinent.
Enter Asimov's rules of robotics. Jemima, Demis Hassabis is a cognitive neuroscientist, and cognitive neuroscientists have a tendency, she says, as a psychologist, to kind of reduce human behavior into, unsurprisingly, systems that we can that are measurable and sort of pulses and all kinds of really fascinating, very specifically detailed things. But it does tend to be a relatively reductive view of human beings, that we are nothing but a series of pulses and sort of stimulants and reactions. So ultimately, what does this mean with regards to Google's artificial intelligence strategy and the way that they're going to be going about this? I know Eric Schmidt was recently at The Guardian, and he made some comments about this. What can you tell us about this?
It does seem a big jump, doesn't it, from, you know, a kind of fairly neutral search box where you type in the thing you want to find, to suddenly be going into artificial intelligence, which, as we've just heard, is a whole different world of experience and opportunity. What Eric said, which was very telling, is that, do you remember the days when Google wanted to index the world's information? Well, now their mission has changed. Eric said that they want to be the world's best personal assistant. And I think that really illustrates a level of sort of intimacy with every part of your life that's very telling. So watch out.
If they're in our homes looking at our thermostats and knowing when we're there.
Well, quite,
if they're suggesting things to us based upon our search results and those people who are similar to us, well, you know, in some ways we're kind of devolving our experience to the machine.
Well, what he said is that they don't want to just answer the questions that you ask. They want to suggest the questions that you should be putting to them.
Get out of my brain, Google. I mean, get out of my brain.
Yeah, they basically want to replace your cognitive functions.
but it's quite interesting because smartphones are really the most personal things that you own. Because
it has so much
of your life in there. It knows where you go because you tend to take it with you. It has all your email, your contacts, your phone numbers, the numbers of all your nearest and dearest and everything. And people are completely comfortable with that. And I sort of sense with some people that they get a bit uneasy about the idea of the smartphone and saying, hey, do you know what? You could, you know, it's going to be, you know, the weather's going to be like this, or your train's going to be a bit late. And the idea that the smartphone goes beyond just being the thing that you control, which is very personal to you, to something where the smartphone takes an active part in the entire conversation, to some people find that uneasy, and I wonder why.
Well, they're going down that road with Google now. They're already heading down that road. And I put to Eric that Google's biggest obstacle is actually people's readiness and their willingness to accept these technologies. Perhaps predictably, he disagreed with that, and he said that actually the obstacle is that the technology just can't do it yet. The technology isn't ready to, you know, they're not there with artificial intelligence, but maybe after buying DeepMind, they will be.
Moving on then. This week, we learned that the U.S. National Security Agency and its U.K. counterpart, GCHQ, have been developing capabilities to take advantage of, quote, leaky smartphone apps. Jemima, this was published by our colleague James Ball out of the U.S. office. Tell us why we should be angry about who's snooping on our Angry Birds.
Well, as Charles just brilliantly observed, mobile phones are incredibly intimate. We feel that the data on those apps is quite sort of walled in a way, that it's less visible, but that's completely false. Any data that is shared in the cloud, we now know the NSA and GCHQ can intercept. So what these documents suggest is that the NSA has been intercepting details from apps. Now, they used Rovio in one of the slides, and Angry Birds is a very compelling example. They have, I think, 1.7 billion users. In that case, the data might be fairly benign, but if you think about a dating app, that would obviously have location, it would have your sexual preference. You might be into swinging, as James intriguingly suggested in his article. You know, there's all sorts of very personal, intimate data. And whether you might be a legitimate target or not, is that the kind of data that should be this accessible? I think the key question that has come out of this is that it looks like it might be the advertising platform companies who are processing this data. And obviously that they want as much rich demographic information as they can get about you. So
taking a step back, Jemima, this is not somebody sort of going into our handsets, these most personal of devices. This is the leaky cloud, ultimately. This is the thing that we stick all of our thoughts and you know, all of our behaviors into, but that is via the technology in our hands, in our pockets, and then it goes elsewhere, and then that's where the problem is. This isn't the problem of the handset manufacturers.
No, this isn't individual handsets being hacked. This is the same kind of, as we understand it, the same kind of interception techniques. So tapping into cables and intercepting data going in or out of data centers as best as we can determine. There has been a furious statement from Rovio in response to this. And they also have said that they're going to have to review the relationships they have with third-party advertising networks. So this is something we will keep following.
I think it is interesting that the NSA and GCHQ are targeting this, and that they spotted very early on that there's so much potential for them in understanding what people are doing through their smartphones. I think that it will be interesting if, as a result of this, rather as the big tech companies, the Apples, Microsofts, Skypes, Googles, and so on, have tightened up what they've done in terms of how data moves between their data centers and how people access the data centers, if much the same happens with data moving on and off your smartphone to advertising platforms. I think that would definitely be a good step.
And there is also a point of good in this, which is that in the US, they've had the advantage of having the big web consumer companies lobbying the government. In the UK, we haven't had that. There is no sort of centre of gravity around that pressure. But what we do have in Europe is some very successful mobile gaming companies. And if companies like Rovio and Supercell, who are small but with huge number of users and a lot of money behind them, you know, if investors sense that there is some consumer unrest around this, we might see some more activity from them.
Is that, Jemima and Charles, do you think the only way that we're going to see advertisers tightening up some of their data protection, their encryption of data regulations, or do you think that there's going to have to be something else that comes along, some kind of consortium, some kind of industry body that states out, you know, these are the best practices?
Well,
frankly, I can imagine that this is quite a difficult area to regulate simply because there are so many different players in this incredibly fertile app market. So how do you make sure that your apps aren't leaky? How do you make sure as a customer, do we look to the advertisers to be ethical?
I think that we're so far from any sort of legal action or follow-up in Europe off the back of, or certainly the UK, off the back of all of the NSA and GCHQ stories. I think the one thing that will make these companies act is if they think that there is a financial cost to it, and I think that's why Google and Facebook moved. I think it was very telling. I spoke to a VC not so long ago, and he said, I asked him if there was perhaps potential new business, significant new business in privacy focused apps and services, and he said no, there's no consumer interest and there's no money in it.
Well, we will keep reporting on this despite the compassion fatigue because we think it's awfully important. So keep reading theguardian.com/technology for more information on this and other stories about the NSA. In 1984, on February 27th, this audacious Orwellian ad crashed onto the TVs of Americans.
We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
Charles, of course, that was the launch of the Apple Mac. For people who never saw the ad, can you describe it, please? And don't forget about the blonde lady running through the crowd with her very short red shorts.
Well, that's sort of the point of it, isn't it? I mean, it was directed by Ridley Scott, who is possibly better known for Alien and Gladiator. Quintus Maximilius, what the hell is my name? And the advert showed, yes, a woman in the sort of red shorts that were at the time quite fashionable, because it was 1984. It was the US Olympics in LA that year. And she throws a hammer, which goes through a giant telescreen where you have a sort of Orwellian figure who is burbling on with to a whole lot of grey-suited people. And the caption in the Apple Garamond font that they used then said, this is why 1984 won't be like 1984. And the answer was the Macintosh. Turned out it wasn't quite like that. And what actually happened was the Macintosh was so fabulously expensive that hardly anyone could really afford it. And lots of businesses went with IBM anyway, because the IBM PC was the same supplier as they had for their IBM mainframes, even if they weren't completely compatible. And what turned quickly into a rout was Microsoft coming along, extending the whole MS-DOS software to a platform which could be built by loads of companies. And by 1995, the whole game was over. Basically, Apple was down to 5% market share, which is pretty much where it stayed. And Windows 95 cemented Microsoft's position in the desktop operating position.
So, Charles, let's just go back to a little bit of the context. The ad, I recall, was an obvious dig at IBM. So what was actually happening at that time in the
personal computer market? Well, the personal computer market was really very nascent. Apple had actually been in it since 1975, and they had come up with the Apple I and then the Apple II, which were sort of breadboard computers and very much the command line interface. You typed sort of obscure collections of words onto an interface, blinking black on or white on black, and it would do things. And the Apple II, I think, or the 2FX had a color interface, but not much better than that. IBM came up with the first PC in 1982, and because they had the corporate market, because PCs then were very expensive, they really weren't consumer items, they began to get a lot of momentum. And what Apple was doing with the Mac was introducing the graphical user interface, which is what we see on pretty much every computer nowadays, the whole idea of Windows and mice. But again, it was very expensive, even though it was very interesting. The Mac actually wasn't the first computer from Apple which had this sort of interface. Before that, they had the Lisa, which was even more expensive, but that was the first one which had the graphical user interface and the mouse and all the fonts. I actually used the Lisa back in the times when CPM still ruled, you know, walked the earth, and MS, you know, Alex is looking around, the what? And you had 12-inch floppies, and they really were floppies, and the Lisa was just a revelation. It was so different. It was so amazing to be able to write things on a keyboard, change the font, print it out, and without having to do all the weird sort of CD and slashes and all this sort of stuff. It really was very, very different. But the problem was pricey.
I recall the very first Apples that appeared at my university. They were the Apple IIe's, and of course they were also immortalized in a comic strip in the U.S. that was called Bloom County. There was an Apple-like computer that one of the characters played around with. I'd always wanted one, but as you say, Charles, they were pretty expensive. And everybody chalked it up to the fact that it was the graphical user interface and everything else. Was it actually a more powerful machine, or was it this very sort of pretty superficial, obviously quite hugely powerful, but this sort of superficial element, or was it? Was it a power horse? Did it have something behind it?
Well, the chips that Apple was using were Motorola chips, and IBM was using Intel chips, so it could make them. IBM could get it cheaper, but again, you know, the IBM PCs were pretty expensive for what they were. But Apple was making it in smaller volumes, and you know, didn't have the backing that IBM had.
Sam, I want to turn to you and have a bit of a step back in time. Tell me about the first Mac that you owned.
Well, I'm afraid it was quite a lot more recent than Charles's experience.
That's all right. We cater to all ages here.
The first Mac I ever owned was a MacBook Pro, and I bought that in 2008, so relatively recently. The funny thing was that as soon as I bought the MacBook Pro, I inherited the use of a PowerMac G4 and then subsequently a G5. So I was well into the Power PCs as well as the brand new Intel chips, and what were the newfangled Intel chips? It was almost a cardinal sin for the original Mac users. But my gateway into the Apple universe was actually the iPod, and I think that was probably the way that quite a lot of at least people of my generation found themselves using Macs through the smaller devices that Apple sold in volume.
Yeah, Alex, tell us about yours, because I think it was you might have to hang your head in shame.
My first Mac, my dad came back with a Power Mac Performer in 1995, and I hated it. I could not, and still to this day cannot, get my head around Apple's pre-OS X interface. A few years later, my mum got an iMac. The same problem. It just was counterintuitive. It didn't work. It felt like I was using a computer with gloves on. So I swore off Apple's for the better part of a decade. Until in 2004, 2005, I got the second generation iPod. And realized that maybe there was something to this company. Maybe they could actually make things that were usable. 4 years later, I'd been one round so fully, I got a PowerBook, a 17-inch PowerBook, a refurbished one, and never looked back.
Charles, there was something that really shifted around 1996, 1997. And it wasn't just the hardware. I think that they reinvigorated their advertising team. Something, you know, there was a sort of a gear change. It was almost as if the zeitgeist had caught up to them again. Was it advertising, or was it actually the hardware, do you think?
It was some guy called Steve Jobs. I don't know where they found him. But yeah, I mean, you know, Jobs came back in 96 because they bought Next Computer, which he happened to be the chief executive of. And he booted out the chief executive of the time, Jill Amelio, and completely reinvigorated the advertising. So that was the key thing. They had, before Jobs, they had had people saying, this is all the stuff that's on my Mac. And so you'd have people like Todd Rundgren sort of holding their PowerBook and saying, these are all the things I keep on my Mac. And they had absolutely zero impact. And then Steve Jobs came back and they did the Think Different campaign, which had people people who they admired. And they were so mysterious. You know, they weren't declarative like the previous adverts. They were just mysterious, as though there was a message that you had to decode. You know, what's this thing, different stuff? What's it about? And that had some effect, I guess. But actually, you know, the thing that tends to be the better advert than anything is actually having a good product.
Well, thank you very much to the team for this momentary nostalgia trip. And don't forget to check out our superb 30 years of Apple Mac and pictures compiled by the tech team Shauna Tregaskis. Just go to theguardian.com/tech. Usman Haque is a UK-based architect and artist whose work focuses on interactive and dynamic installations, creating physical systems and bespoke software to change how people react in and to a building or space. His work has meant that he's been at the forefront of thinking around networked responsive technologies, or the Internet of Things, as it's become known. To discuss this subject, I spoke with Usman and started by asking how this technological paradigm became so important to him.
So I'm trained as an architect originally, actually, in the very traditional sense of being kind of interested in buildings and cities and people in space. And I got involved very early on in building interactive spaces, interactive environments, and being really interested in this question of how do people relate to each other and their spaces in a world where buildings and devices become kind of dynamic and responsive. And so a few years ago, I launched a platform called PatchBay, which had a bit of a funny spelling, P-A-C-H-U-B-E.
Yeah, it did. Just as an aside, can you explain why? Because I've looked at that and and I just cannot deconstruct it with my phonics brain on.
A patch bay is like a switchboard where you can plug anything into anything else. And the spelling came about partly because I was thinking of launching it in East Asia, and I was sort of doing a sort of phonetic spelling of patchbay. That's one story that we give for the foundation.
That's the one that you tell the press,
exactly.
Right?
and so I launched this platform back in, I think it was sort of around 2007-ish or so, at a time when not many people were necessarily thinking about the Internet of Things so much as just thinking about getting data online from the physical world, you know, connecting physical spaces together using the internet or physical devices. And PatchBay was essentially, it was just a basic kind of data repository for very generalized sensor data. So whether you had a pollution monitor or a weather station or an energy monitor or an air quality monitor or what have you, PatchBay was almost like a kind of Twitter or YouTube, if you like, where you could sort of push that data and make it available to other people in order for them to be able to access it and do stuff that with it as well. So to that extent,
what you're suggesting right there is you've kind of given us a bit of a definition of Internet of Things. It sounds like it's mostly for environmental effects or other things. But certainly the first time I heard about Internet of Things, though it wasn't called that at that point, was, you know, something like having an RFID chip in a pint glass and that spoke with, you know, the tap at the bar and told the tap at the bar that you know, your pint glass is empty. I suppose you could extrapolate this to the never dying and ever resurrecting internet fridge idea as well. So what else does Internet of Things include?
Well, so it's an interesting question, because of course there are thousands of definitions for the Internet of Things. What I'm mostly interested in is this idea of the kind of remote connectivity between things that are near to us and things that are further away, where rather than just thinking about the internet being something that you and I access through a keyboard and a screen, the internet is actually employed by devices, so sensors like you know, traffic monitors. It's accessed by things that are perhaps controlling each other without direct human intervention. But the important thing for me, I think, is not to forget about the people at the, you know, that are actually making use of these devices. And so to that extent, the Internet of Things is just a sort of handy way of saying what's going on the internet now, if you see what I mean, because there is really no clear distinction between the Internet of Things in terms of computers just connecting to each other and the Internet of Things, meaning sensors that are basically computers also connected to each other, if you see what I mean. So I think it's a kind of handy catchphrase to encompass this this kind of connectivity between the physical and the virtual, I suppose, would be the thing that makes it most interesting to me. That now the physical world, the world that we're kind of walking around with in, is able to interact with digital representations of it, which might be things like blogs. It might be actually triggering other devices to do things, or it might be giving us information to act on environmental or other data about decisions we're trying to make.
Can you give me an example, a kind of a concrete real world example? Because I love it philosophically and theoretically. I can't quite visualize it.
So there was a company called Asmopolis, and I'm totally blanking on what name they're called now because they did change their name. But they were called, they were at one point called Asmopolis. And what they provided was basically, and continue to provide, is basically an asthma pump that is connected to your phone. And as you're living your life and walking around the city, it is able to keep track of where you have tended to needed to use the asthma pump. This is, of course, for asthma sufferers. Now, that's one thing, is to be able to see where you have tended to need your asthma pump. But what actually happens is that this data is aggregated, and you can actually be given a warning when you're entering an area, perhaps one that you've never been before, but where other asthma sufferers have found an increase in need for that asthma pump. And this is a really interesting idea here, because it's not just about, you know, the sort of internet connected fridge is really quite a mundane thing, but it's also it's based on a very sort of one-to-one connection. It's me to my fridge and then maybe the fridge to the store. But the idea of Asmopolis is a kind of many-to-many, where I'm kind of making use of and contributing to the decision-making that other people are going through as well. And so I'm able to use an asthma pump when I need to, because I've been given a warning about where others have needed the asthma pump in the past.
So fast forward then from Patch Bay, which was in many ways a platform for people to come and share and to allow their data to kind of to. It was a service, basically, that allowed data to kind of go through and then go back out to people within the community. Tell me about the new company that you've set up within the last couple of weeks.
So at the time of Patch Bay, I think, that, of course, it was largely confined to a kind of community of people that were kind of makers and developers. But now, sort of 5 or 6 years later, actually there's a lot more connected devices that you can just buy off the shelf. Things like Fitbit, you know, sort of fitness trackers. There are a whole variety of connected weather stations. You can buy air quality monitors and what have you. So there's this kind of world of connected devices that's a lot more evident now than before. But nobody necessarily knows where they are. Even things that are generating public data, like weather stations or air quality monitors, you wouldn't know if there was public data, for example, on your street. If you wanted to know, for example, what is the air quality like in your neighborhood, you can't just Google and sort of find out if somebody else is making that data available in public. So we launched this, basically it's a kind of discoverability engine, if you like, for the public Internet of Things last month, called Thingful, thingful.net. And the idea is that you can search for different types of connected devices, connected sensors, basically in a geographical sense on a map. You can find out what is connected near you. And ultimately, we'd also like you to be able to connect to people who are interested in the same kind of phenomena as you. So if you're interested in energy, for example, you can find other public energy providers, data providers, or other public energy monitors in and around your neighborhood, that you might then be able to either have a discussion about that data, or you might even be able to set up some kind of program or community even around that data.
To what degree was this a response to the fact that suddenly the people who are making Internet of Things, the sensors and collecting the data, were starting to become almost too large, and people who didn't have necessarily the same morals or the same intentions, the openness as much of the early small community felt? And specifically, I'm thinking about in London, there was the bins that were found to be tracking people's Mac addresses on their internet-enabled mobile phones, when the wireless was open. Now, to what degree is Thingful a response to that in order to kind of grab the community back and make people aware?
So it is definitely very much about trying to put people at the heart of this question. You know, can finding out what's in and around you, finding out more about people that are interested in the same kind of phenomena as you. And one of the analogies I like to make is, you know, in the early days of the web, back when it was still a kind of, you know, your web page would be a gray background and blue underlined links, and people would access the web usually via something like, you know, CompuServe or Delphi or AOL or something like that. Now, you ended up having a very curated vision of the web, and it took the very early search engines, things like Yahoo, and then there was AltaVista, and later on came Google. It took those search engines for you to realize that there was much more out there on the web. And we're trying to do a very similar kind of thing here, which is to say, you know, there are all of these kind of relatively closed communities, even if they're public. The communities of data interest people, or communities around particular fitness apps or devices that are monitoring air quality, are kind of closed silos, because they don't necessarily know about people that are perhaps using a different model or a different company's data. They don't know necessarily that right next door to them, if they're interested in pollution data, that actually there might be some kind of correlation to traffic data, which they would actually not know about because they're on a different data network. And so with Thinkful, we're trying to kind of, you know, at this stage at least, simply make it more easy to find out what's near and around you. You know, simply make it possible to find out that there are other people that are perhaps interested in the same things, that are already kind of amassing the kind of data that you might either be able to use directly, or perhaps through some kind of application or some other kind of tool, not necessarily that you're building something, but simply to know that there is kind of a community of interest around you.
And certainly this is interesting as more and more companies are starting to create platforms specifically for Internet of Things. Here I'm thinking of something like the Berg Cloud, which is starting to host lots of interesting different Internet of Things services. You know, occasionally they spit things out via their little printer, which is a physical manifestation of the platform, but obviously the platform itself is moving into different areas. And also we're starting to see some of the big players getting into the Internet of Things space. Intel recently announced a Pentium PC on an SD card, which is itself could be a platform for sensors or for data. Stephen Wolfram from Wolfram Alpha is also entering this space. And so ultimately, we're starting to see this turn into a more maturing enterprise, a space where platforms are now starting to become very important for all, as you say, of the different communities of data that are out there and kind of coalescing around different organizations.
Yeah, so I think that we're at an interesting stage right now where and you know, here I want to talk about the distinction between public and private, which I think is less clear than perhaps we is sometimes kind of it's described in very black and white terms, but actually the notion of privacy and what is public and what do I allow other people to have access to is actually quite a nuanced question. And especially around the, you know, in light of the both the sort of NSA revelations, as well as just being surrounded by more devices that we don't even own that are generating data about us, as well as our own devices that are generating data about us. There's quite a complex kind of web of data and data rights, and a need for some kind of data management, if you like, that enables people. Not to, you know, it's not just about having a single choice of saying, I am either going to make this entirely public or entirely private. I think it's a much more nuanced thing where people understand that they are willing to make their data available to others, which might not necessarily be the whole wide public, but perhaps third-party providers of some service in a limited format, let's say, you know, restricted resolution or only a certain date range or what have you, in return for something that might be a service that gives them something useful or beneficial. And you can only start to kind of have that conversation, I think, once you know everything that's out there and around you. You know, and when everything is stuck in their own kind of silos, you know, and frankly, whether that is the Berg Cloud or some other data provider, the extent to which they preserve their own kind of closed network is the extent to which I'm not sure they're necessarily going to be sustainable until they're able to look out and see what's on all the other data infrastructures and networks.
What do you think of the folks like Intel and Stephen Wolfram entering the space? How do you think it's going to affect the maker community and the other Internet of Things community?
Well, I'm always very interested in what Wolfram has, because I think at first glance, it sort of leaves a lot of people scratching their heads, but then somewhere down the line, it all kind of makes sense. So I'm definitely interested to see what they're doing, especially because the idea of an ontology of connected devices, which seems to be what they're doing with their new initiative, is another part of the puzzle that we're also trying to crack with Thingful. In other words, knowing not just what's out there, but how to categorize it. Helps all of that become a lot more useful. With respect to the sort of the very large companies like Intel, I do get the impression somewhat that they are scrambling to make sure that they are relevant in the coming years, if you see what I mean. Because I think there are now so many more players, both in the technology space, but actually more specifically in the kind of connected products market, that they're trying to figure out how to continue to be relevant. But I think they're also struggling a little bit to figure out exactly what their business model is going to be, because there are companies, and you know, I think this is true for Cisco as well, where they've had a kind of traditional business model built around, let's say, in Cisco's case, basically servers and routers, routing information. So it would seem to be at first glance absolutely crucial to what's going on in the Internet of Things. But I'm not sure necessarily that the way these things were sold in the past is going to continue to be the way it's sold in the near future.
Many thanks to Usman, and to delve deeper into his work, just go to his site, hack.co.uk. That's all on today's show. Remember, for breaking tech news day or night, just go to theguardian.com/technology. But for me, Alex Kwiatkowski, Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, and the whole Guardian tech team, thank you very much for listening, and do come back next Wednesday.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.